Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Starting with some NFL news. Now, when the news broke yesterday that Browns offensive tackle Greg Robinson and a former NFL receiver, Quan Bray, were being arrested with what TMZ referred to, quote, as a lot, in all caps. TMZ had it, a lot, in all caps, of pot in their vehicle. I've got to be honest, I was really intrigued and really interested, but I've been down this road before. I knew better than to get my hopes up. I know, I've done this a long, long time. Even when you hear about somebody facing a federal charge of possession with intent to distribute, it can still be deceiving. It may not be what you think it is. Because sometimes the headlines make it sound like it's something really big, when really it's just slightly more that can be justified for personal use. And then honestly, it's a major letdown. Again, I've been down that road before. I know better. So, because I'm experienced, I never rush in, I always manage my expectations, and I remind myself constantly to be patient and to just wait for the official announcement from the authorities. And then late yesterday, it became official. And I quote, in El Paso today, federal authorities file a criminal complaint against 27-year-old Gregory Keith Robinson and 26-year-old Jaquan Bray for conspiring to possess with intent to distribute marijuana. End quote. All right, so now that's a start. But as always, it's coming down to the details. According to a press release, quote, on Monday evening, the defendants approached the Sierra Blanca checkpoint station where a U.S. Border Patrol Canine United alert on their vehicle. Agents asked the driver to park the vehicle in the secondary inspection area for further investigation. A subsequent inspection of the vehicle by agents revealed the presence of approximately 157 pounds of marijuana inside several large duffel bags in the rear cargo area, end quote. 157 pounds. 157 pounds of Kron. 157. That is the weight of an adult male. Greg Robinson was rolling around with Manny Pacquiao's body weight in weed in the back of his SUV. Manny Pacquiao's body weight and then some. 157 pounds is a lightweight UFC fighter before a weight cut. That weed would have to get into a sauna and drop 2 pounds before it would be allowed to get in the cage with Habib. And this guy is just driving around with all of that in the back of his car? 157 pounds is more than I weigh right now. I would have to hit a few In-N-Out chocolate shakes to ding the scale with what that guy had in the back of his truck. 157. But before you next start saying that he's the next Pablo Escobar, depending on the quality of the product, he was driving around with anywhere between 300 grand and 750 gur in street value pot. Now, that seems like a lot of money, right? Until you remember that Greg Robinson's salary with the Browns last season was $5.5 million before roster bonuses. In other words, this guy's driving around with roughly a game check of Kron. And for that, he is now facing the possibility of 20 years in prison. They got a word for something like that. Dumbass.
Dumbass.
As always, I hope that was worth it. Although I know it's not. This guy's looking at possibly doing 20 in the joint when he was an active NFLer like 20 minutes ago. He's an even worse drug dealer than he was an offensive tackle. And he was a terrible offensive tackle. Because the details of this are amazing. Check it out. According to the affidavit, in support of the complaint, they weren't just found with duffel bags full of vacuum-sealed plastic bags of marijuana. They were also found with the following. 23 glass mason jars. A, quote, very large and very heavy automatic 420 single-ended electric can sealer, an electric scale, and approximately $3,100 in cash. Yeah, pretty hard to get away with the personal consumption defense when you've got an adult body's weight of the lettuce, vacuum sealed, in duffel bags, and even tougher when you've got a scale, 23 mason jars, and a jar sealer with you as well. I mean, hell, it's like a mobile office. Practically a mobile meth lab. Except it was pot and not meth. I mean, it's not quite Nate Newton getting pulled over with 213 pounds of weed, getting charged, getting released on bond, and then getting pulled over 6 weeks later with 175 pounds of weed. But man, it's pretty close. You aren't knocking on Nate Newton's door, but you're in Nate Newton's neighborhood. He sees you and he respects you, Greg Robinson. And it gets even more absurd because Robinson and Bray were not the only two people in that vehicle. There was a third. Let me go back to the press release for this key detail. Quote, the complaint affidavit further states that Robinson rented the vehicle in Los Angeles on Sunday and had arranged for a third individual in the vehicle, an Uber driver that he had met in 2018 to drive him and Bray to Louisiana. End quote. Man, this is so good. I hope it never ends. The third individual was an Uber driver that Robinson met in 2018. He's referred to in the affidavit as passenger two. And this individual, who has not been charged, said that he or she met Robinson in Louisiana in 2018. Robinson paid he or she to do some extra driving and run some errands. So for this trip, Robinson told passenger two that he and a friend would be going from LA back to Louisiana, and then Robinson would pay for passenger two to drive them as well as cover hotel and flight for passenger two. Yeah, I don't know. I don't do it, but if you were an Uber driver, how hyped would you be on a ride from LA to Louisiana? Good work if you can get it, allegedly. So Robinson picks up passenger two at a Motel 6 near LAX at 5 o'clock in the morning on Monday. When passenger two tried to put his or her bag in the back of the car, Bray grabbed it and put it behind the passenger seat instead. Just so we are clear, they're driving 157 pounds of the hippie lettuce from Cali to Louisiana with an Uber driver. Yo, Greg. The hell were you doing?
What were you doing?
Just taking all that pot in California and moving it to Louisiana? And how the hell did you get to the Sierra Blanca checkpoint if you're going from California to Louisiana? Like, I know it's tempting to just get on the 10, head east, put it on cruise control. However, if you're driving with Conor McGregor's weight in weed in the back, I don't know, maybe go a little farther north. And I don't know, maybe you try to avoid all the checkpoints and the drug-sniffing canines. Yeah, funny we bring that up. Because passenger two claims that at one point when they were driving, passenger two was a little over the speed limit. A police car turns on its lights. Robinson and Bray started getting, quote, very nervous. But the police car pulled over a different vehicle. Then Robinson asked passenger two to look for the U.S. Border Patrol checkpoints that were on the Maps app. Passenger two is getting a little bit nervous now. Passenger two says, as they approached El Paso, Robinson said the passenger two was looking tired, and then Robinson told Bray to drive. I know this is long. Follow along. At that point, Robinson starts to coach passenger two on what to say if they are pulled over and to tell the authorities that he or she was a U.S. citizen. Passenger two said he or she was not a citizen, but had a residency card. And then, quote, passenger two stated that as they approached the U.S. Border Patrol checkpoint, both Bray and Robinson got very nervous. I don't know why. Why were those dudes nervous? Because they had a body's worth of pot in the back and there were drug-sniffing dogs? Would that make you nervous? And here's where it gets good. Passenger two stated that Robinson told him or her, will you take it? I will pay you. Passenger two stated he or she said, what do you mean? To which Robinson said, there's a lot of marijuana. Can you take it? End quote. Freaking awesome. I mean, just outstanding. Attaboy, G. You're the man. You're driving with 157 pounds of weed, you're getting busted, and then you turn to your Uber driver and say, hey, yo, can you take it? Yo, buddy, Yo, buddy, you aren't asking somebody to hold a bag for you. You're asking for somebody to hold duffel bags for you. 157 pounds in duffel bags. You don't ask an Uber driver to do that, or a Lyft driver for that matter. Yo, man. Hey, what's up? Can you do me a solid? Hey, say the 157 pounds of weed are yours. Pick me up, home slice. Say it's yours. Do the 20-year stretch for me, and I swear, man, I will give you a 5-star review, a 5-star rating. Oh, I'll tip you out. I got you, my man. Just say it's your dope. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Greg Robinson is an even worse drug dealer than he was an offensive tackle, and he was one of the worst offensive tackles. This guy was bad at football, but even worse at drugs. Now he's a draft bust and a drug bust. Hey-oh! And right about now, Rob Manfred is the happiest man in America because for at least one moment, the spotlight is off of him and it's on Greg Robinson. Damn, Greg Robinson makes Commissioner of Baseball look like he's got his bleep together. Michael Orr had the blind side. Greg has got the blunt side. Second pick in the 2014 draft. As bad as Blake Bortles, who is the third pick, has been, I don't think we have to worry about Blake Bortles getting a Lyft driver to caravan a ton of meth to San Diego. You gotta be kidding me. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake or eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire, and it goes wherever you go. To the game, to the gym, to the beach. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Charles Robinson. Charles, brother, what's up? How are you?
I don't even want to know what Yasmin Bleef photos are out there. I need to work the rest of the day, so whatever
good.
That is.
Yeah, you can't unsee it. See, they almost got me. I almost got hooked. I almost said you can't unsee what you've seen, but I'm not going to say that, and I just don't care. It's neither here nor there. You're right. You're fine. All right, so that's not one of the big topics, but there are two big topics I want to hit you with today. That's not one of them. Potential expansion of the regular season and postseason, and Greg Robinson. Now, normally I would start with the expansion of the regular season and the playoffs, but as somebody who has been around this league for a long, long time, what is your reaction when you hear that Robinson was detained in Texas with allegedly 157 pounds of marijuana in his SUV?
Just a smidge of weed,
right?
In his SUV. We're still not to, you know, some of the levels that I think we've seen in the past. I mean, there are some former Dallas Cowboys that I think were nabbed with actually twice or triple that amount. Yeah, that does not appear to be a recreational amount of marijuana, but, you know, hey, some people like to have a stash that's never going to run out. That's not a great look for Greg Robinson. You know, this is a guy that over the expanse of his NFL career, I think the number one complaint I probably heard more often than not in all of his stops starting with the Rams was, you know, you tell him something 20 times and it just doesn't sink in. Concentration's a problem. Well, you know, now maybe we can understand why concentration might have been a problem for Greg Robinson.
Charles Robinson joining us. Well said. So when we talk about a 17-game season, of course, it's about the money. How much money, though? How much money are we possibly talking about for a 17-game season and an expanded postseason?
Well, so the way it was put to me going back to last offseason was that every one game that was added to the schedule would ultimately, once it was seen to fruition, represent about $1 billion for NFL players in the system for NFL players. Now, you know, spread over 32 teams, that's not a ton of money when you consider – you know, how that ultimately gets divided up, particularly if, you know, you're talking about roster expansion, things of that nature. And I remember I talked to Malcolm Jenkins about this last summer, and, you know, we were standing in the locker room. He said, man, look around. He said, look around this locker room. How many guys in this room are going to see that added money? He said, it's not going to be a lot of these guys. It's going to end up being the upper tier guys, the top two or three stars are going to be the guys who soak up whatever additional money is put in the system. And that's why Malcolm Jenkins, when we talked about it, he felt like an expansion of the regular season was unlikely. But look, from what I understand, we're talking about minimum salaries being raised here. We're talking about, you know, additional roster spots, which is more jobs for players, which by and large, once you get past the stars, most guys are going to be in favor of an extra game check. Most guys are going to be in favor of extra jobs out there that keep them in the NFL longer. And I know a lot of players are complaining about, you know, or well, at least you're hearing some players complain about the extra game. Two things to keep in mind. Number one, if you want leverage, you argue most vehemently against the thing your opponent wants. The NFL owners want the 17th game more than anything, so players build leverage by coming out and complaining that it goes against player safety. And then number two, what are we talking about here? The average NFL lifespan, you know, careers last 3, 4, 5 years. That's 3, 4, 5 total games in the career of most NFL players. The guys who are going to see the most games added are the guys who last 10, 12, 14 years. And most of those NFL players who last that long rarely ever play full 16-game seasons every single year, year in, year out. So I think there's a lot of complaining about this that really isn't going to amount to much once this finally gets passed. And when we're in the midst of a 17-game season, I just don't see a lot of people complaining about it.
Talking to Charles Robinson, who laid that all out. You know, I was going to ask you, and I thought maybe I will anyway, what about that issue of safety? And I know you addressed it, but Richard Sherman's made the point that the league says it's all about player health, but then pushes for that 17th regular season game. He feels like it's hypocritical. Do you think it is?
I don't think it's hypocritical when you consider it's a balance. The league is trying to strike a balance here. Okay, the product, it's making a ton of money. It's pushing for this $25 billion you know, annual revenue target down the line. And look, they're legislating more and more hits out of the game, right? More and more violence is getting legislated out of the game. Well, there are a lot of players that are hypocritical who sit there and talk about you can't hit anyone anymore, you can't do this, you can't do that, which essentially is an argument for violence. But then they turn around and say, oh, geez, now they want an extra game. How could we have an extra game? That's so against player safety. No, there's a balance that's trying to be struck here. The NFL is not trying to remove all violence out of football, but at the same time, they're trying to elongate careers, make the product more exciting on the field, and make more money. Well, you got to give something up to gain something. And, you know, I understand that adding an extra game to these careers, it's not great. It does, you know, elongate the season for some people, but that's one extra week of work. And then strike it against if there's less off-season work, less wear and tear on these players, which they want. That's a step in favor of elongating careers. There's just less grind in the off-season. You have more time to recuperate in the off-season. If you're not canceling careers because of weed, and you may even allow therapeutic use exemptions in states where it's legal for weed to be used for medicinal purposes, that's another thing that's tilting in favor of the health and safety of players. There are changes being made. I think they're just striking a balance here. And look, I, from the league standpoint, I'm not going to ignore that this is good for the league. I think one thing that's remarkable about this for the NFL, if you add one extra game to the regular season and you take away that number two seed, taking away that number two seed means two extra playoff games, one extra regular season game means you literally just created out of thin air a 33rd NFL franchise because you've replicated 16 more regular season games, two more regular season games. Every single year you're going to have a 33rd NFL franchise in the aggregate playing a full NFL season and two playoff games. Pretty remarkable.
It is. Charles Robinson joining us. All right, so before you go, I know that you're already doing your homework for the build-up to the combine. Let me ask you about Cincinnati and Joe Burrow. Can you see a scenario in which he forces his way out of Cincinnati?
I think it's going to depend on who else maybe below Cincinnati wants Joe Burrow. Now, look, Cincinnati, the goal right now is Joe Burrow. That's who they want. They're sitting there, they're staring at Joe Burrow. They're like, we want to take Joe Burrow at number one overall. Well, once the process gets started, they're going to hear offers. I'd be stunned if Cincinnati wasn't willing to pick up the phone and listen if, hey, the Miami Dolphins want to place that call. Hey, if the Carolina Panthers want to call about Joe Burrow and moving up to number one. I think the key here for Cincinnati, whether or not they'd ever move out of that number one spot, it's going to depend on the other quarterbacks. What is, you know, Tua Tagovailoa's medical report going to look like? What is Jordan Love going to look like when he starts to light up these workouts and people start to talk about, you know, could this potentially be, you know, a slightly rougher Pat Mahomes? You know, what's it going to look like when, you know, you get Justin Herbert stacking up another great, you know, phase of the offseason the way he did with the Senior Bowl? I think if Cincinnati's sitting there and they go, look, we really like Jordan, we really like Joe Burrow, but all of a sudden we see a couple other quarterbacks that we think are maybe a little closer in the evaluation than we initially thought. If someone's willing to offer us a boatload of picks and move up and we can still get a quarterback who's pretty darn close to what we want in Joe Burrow and also get all these additional picks, I think maybe that conversation becomes a little more interesting.
Charles Robinson joining us. All right, so really quickly, what about Tua, who you mentioned? Last year at this time, the thinking was Tua would have been the first pick in the draft. What's your sense as to how teams view him and his medical situation?
Tua's uneven. His evaluation, I mean, early in the process right now, and again, we're not going to see him on the field really until, I guess, April. It's really uneven when you talk to teams that are starting to look at him. Number one, he's always playing in a clean pocket most of the time. He's throwing in windows that are wide open. He's not throwing in a ton of tight windows. So his film has been difficult for a lot of teams to really sit there and get a grade on it where they feel great about it because of the surrounding pieces around him, because of the fact that he has played in so many clean situations with Alabama. And then there's some realities about Tua. He hasn't always played his best football in big games. He's not Deshaun Watson, where every time he flipped on, you know, a big game with Clemson, Deshaun Watson was destroying an opponent or just completely disassembling, you know, a defense with NFL caliber players on it. So that's a whole other component beyond just the medical that I think is going to be really tough for teams with Tua. And I'm just telling you, in the early going right now, I'm not hearing that he's a slam dunk as the second quarterback off the board in this draft. And a lot of people are saying, well, geez, Detroit's going to take him at three. Let's wait and see. I'm telling you, Justin Herbert, Jordan Love, those are two guys that in this process I think can really make some noise and potentially elevate themselves to the number two quarterback off the board.
Charles, last thought. What about Herbert? There's been a rap on him in the past that he's kind of an introvert. When you talk to teams and you talk to evaluators, what kind of things do you hear about him as a leader and a personality?
I think what's interesting to me is I heard this going all the way to the Manning Passing Academy last summer, and I had a chance to spend some time with him there, and I was like, I don't get it. Like, he seems social. You know, he's somewhat quiet, but I didn't see this sort of, oh, there's sort of a weird personality or he's an introvert. I was like, no, I just didn't see that. I mean, he's not a full-blown extrovert, but he didn't come off as weird or anything like that. And I think a lot of teams have sort of heard that in the evaluation process. How's he going to deal with, you know, his teammates? Is he too introverted? What's going to happen when the spotlight's on him? What was interesting to me was when he went to the Senior Bowl, it was clear teams asked the Senior Bowl staff to kind of put him in positions where he would have to interact with a ton of teammates and a wide variety of different personalities and guys on his team. And then also in some of the community events, be thrust in that spotlight and deal with sort of the forward-facing public sort of situation he would have to deal with if he was the number one draft pick of or a first-round pick of an NFL franchise. And what I heard was during Senior Bowl week, he actually passed that with flying colors. He was not weird at all. Like, he was very good in the spotlight. He handled all the community events really well. And the thing that really stuck out to me, I heard any of his teammates, no matter what background they came from, ethnicity, it didn't matter. The full cross section, they all really enjoyed interacting with him. He talked to all these guys. It just, I think he came out of the Senior Bowl event where people were like, this whole knock on him sort of being this introvert is not necessarily accurate.
He is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. He is a co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast. And as I mentioned at the top, good friend of the program, he is Charles Robinson. Charles, thank you so much. Always appreciate you and the conversation.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, Rome.
All right, so Adam Schefter reported yesterday that the NFL is looking to expand the regular season and the playoffs. Quote, under the current CBA proposal that NFL owners are pushing for, the playoff field would be expanded to 7 teams from each conference, while the regular season would be increased to 17 games per team and the preseason shortened to 3 games per team, sources said. So what that means is, if the CBA is approved, the 17-game season would start in 2021 at the earliest, But the new playoff format would go into effect in 2020 if the CBA is approved in time, and it looks like it might be. So under the new playoff format, seven teams from each conference would make the postseason, but only one team, the number one seed, would get a bye in the first round. Everybody else would have to win four games to win the Super Bowl. And of course, the question is, why? And the answer is the same as it always is. Because they can. It's the reason anybody does anything, because they can. Well, that and the money. That and the money, because of course money is what's driving this. Owners have been jonesing for that 17th game for a long time. Of course, it means more money for them. And it's not the owners' bodies that are getting jacked up in that 17th game. Like, I'm guessing if Bob Kraft and Jerry Jones were out there taking the spike before a game, playing with broken digits and getting lit up by 250-pound trucks moving at 4-3 speed, they might feel a little bit differently about that 17th game. And don't tell me that swapping out an exhibition game for a regular season game means the players are still playing the same number of games, because that's an idiotic argument. One is an exhibition game. The other is an actual NFL game with starters playing, stakes on the line, and guys getting banged up and injured. And then they want to expand the playoffs for the same reason. They want the extra regular season game. More money. Because apparently they're not making enough money as it is. Like, the NFL's proposal isn't nearly as moronic as baseball's idea for a selection show where teams get to pick who they want to play. But that's only because that was the worst idea ever. But just because this idea is not as bad as what MLB cooked up, and just because people will definitely watch more playoff games, doesn't mean it's a good idea. I mean, was there anybody anywhere saying that the current playoff format was broken? No. I've never heard anybody say that it wasn't perfect the way it is. You have two divisional champions who get byes. That rewards them for 16 games of excellence. And then you've got two divisional champs who host the wildcard game. The only time you hear anybody complain about the current format is when a wildcard team has to go on the road to play a divisional champ with a worse record, like the Seahawks had to do this year. That's the only complaint you ever get. You never hear anybody saying, damn, I wish the seventh place team had gotten in this year. Man, it would be great to see more football from a team that could barely get above 500. And that's for a reason. I mean, yes, this year the extra team would have meant historic matchups like the Steelers going to Kansas City and the Rams playing at the Packers in the first weekend. But think about that for a minute. The Rams were 9-7. They lost two of their last three games. Did they look like a playoff team? The Steelers lost their last three games. They were 8-8. They didn't even have a winning record. Did they look like a playoff team? Was anybody saying, man, I really need to see Duck Hodges in a playoff game? You know, Duck Hodges, who threw for 95 yards in the season finale against the Ravens. Did anybody need to see another game of that? I mean, sure, there might have been some years where a 10-win team doesn't get in. But those are the breaks. If 10 wins doesn't get you in, you should have won 11 or 12. That's how it is. At least, that's how it should be. So under the new model, Kansas City would not have had a bye. You'd be punishing them and rewarding the Steelers for being 500. The proposed new model would put an incredible premium on being the number one seed, but it punishes the number two seed. And it rewards the number seven seed. That doesn't make any sense. You finish 500 and you still get into the playoffs. You want to talk about a participation trophy? Under the new model, if you get that number one seed, you have such an enormous advantage over everybody else because you're the only team that gets to rest in January. The others have got to slog it out for another quarter of a season. This isn't just fixing something that's not broken. It's breaking something that's really good and doing so in the name of only making more money that you will never get to anyway. Of course, it'll make more money. And of course, everybody will watch it. But people watch Thursday Night Football and nobody thinks that's good, because it's not. It's generally terrible. It waters down the drink. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. But that has never stopped the NFL before. So like in this case, more is not better. More is just more lucrative. There's a difference. It ain't broke. Leave it alone. Kelly Bryant. Kelly, it's good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I appreciate you for having me on.
It's good to have you. In fact, we haven't done this in a couple of years, so it's good to get caught up. Let me ask you this. You're a few days away from the start of the Combine. How have you been approaching your preparation for the Combine, and how eager are you to get there and get to work?
Oh, man, this is the interview of a lifetime. And you know, once I got the news that, you know, I would be attending the Combine, I just, you know, knew that, you know, the 4 days I'm there, you know, that's a chance for me to allow teams to get to know me from a personality standpoint, and also for a lot of people to see, you know, on the field work and, you know, how I test. And, you know, just the opportunity of a lifetime for me. So I'm just happy, you know, and blessed when I get to, you know, be in the spot where I can have the platform to, you know, showcase my abilities.
Kelly Bryant joining us. Now, you've had an amazing journey to be where you are right now. Just so people understand this, you grew up in Calhoun Falls, South Carolina, population 2,000. What was life like growing up in Calhoun Falls?
Oh, man. So whenever someone asks me where I'm from, you know, 99% of the time, no one really knows. So, you know, I have to really, you know, do a good job of explaining that. But, you know, like I said, small town, one red light, 7-Eleven, Dollar General. And the Dollar General is pretty much like our Walmart there. So it's not a lot of much to do there. But, you know, just being in a small town and just being from South Carolina, it just, you know, shaped me to who I am today.
We're talking to Kelly Bryant. Now, your mom, Deborah, talks about how you had this amazing energy really from the jump, that you were like the Tasmanian devil because you were always running around. In fact, one time, she said that you were going to climb the side of a house until the side of your house until she talked you out of it. Is that true?
Yes, sir. That is true. I didn't even know. Oh, man. So Spider-Man is my favorite like superhero. And, like, growing up, I always wanted everything Spider-Man, from the costume to the little web goo. And just me, I was just, like I said, so energetic that, you know, that's basically what I wanted to do. You know, what I saw on TV and in the movies, I just wanted to be, you know, the real-life Spider-Man. So, yes, sir, that was me.
I love it. Kelly Bryant joining us. Now, the summer before your junior year, you went to Wren High School. And then shortly after you arrived, you met Tanner Donahoe, another student who had Down syndrome. You and Tanner really hit it off. Tanner's father talks about what you mean to Tanner and the entire family. How would you describe your relationship with them?
Oh, man. They've been a blessing to me. When I first met Tanner and his mom, it was orientation right before school started. And I was with my mom, and we was going through, like, meeting all the teachers that was on my schedule. And literally, I remember walking by them, and his mom was like, "Hey, Tanner, he can be your protector, I guess," because it was his first time as well coming into the school. And, you know, me just making a conversation, and then, you know, we went about the rest of the night. And literally from there, you know, I saw him in school, you know, hey, you know, talking to him, seeing him at lunch, and then the relationship just grew. And, you know, just since then, man, their family has been so really open and so well for me. And my family, just how we've just bonded together, you know, they've just been a blessing to me as well.
That's a great story. Kelly Bryant joining us. Now, Kelly, you tweeted the other day that you're going to be raising much for the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation with your performance at the Combine. Thing is, when you were a junior in high school, you got really sick during a game and you were vomiting blood. I would imagine that was really scary. What do you remember about that time?
Junior year and in the middle of a basketball game. So I had not been feeling really well, like, that whole week, and just was at the game, and it just felt like I had to throw up, and I just remember throwing up, and the team had just left to go back and finish the game, but I just stood back, you know, in the locker room because I just didn't feel well, and throwing up, and then my high school coach, football coach, Coach Jeff Tate, came in, got my parents in there immediately. We got rushed to the hospital, and it was really a scary time for me because, like I said, I'm a 17-year-old kid in the best shape of my life at the time. And just to go through that whole, you know, process, you know, just being in the hospital for 2.5 months without being able to eat and just not knowing what's going on and have to go through the surgery and get the infection out of my stomach. And then also just, you know, learning how to walk and eat again, gain weight. You know, it was a really scary time, but, you know, through my family and my friends and the support and everyone I had around me, you know, just helped me to get back on my feet.
Now, Kelly, just so we're clear about this, you went to the hospital and doctors found a softball-sized abscess and you were diagnosed with Crohn's disease. You spent all that time there. You lost nearly, actually more than 50 pounds. Your parents were at your bedside every single night. Your grandmothers were there during the day. It seems to me it would have been pretty easy at that point for you to say, you know what, football's not in the cards. My career is over. But you didn't. How come?
Man, I'm a fighter. Mr. Rome, you know, it's been a story of my life. You know, just had to deal with a lot of things, adverse situations. You know, just whenever I just have a tough time, you know, I just revert back to, you know, being in that hospital bed, looking at my grandmother's, just each and every day when my parents was at work. And, you know, it just gives me an extra fuel to my fight. And, you know, that's just been my testament, just been my story, you know, each and every day, you know, how to get up and get out of bed.
Kelly Bryant, you are a fighter. There's no doubt about that. So you go to Clemson, and then you ultimately end up at Missouri. When you first went to Missouri, what was it that made you feel like that was the place for you?
Like I said, I had announced that I was leaving Clemson, and you know now I'm getting pretty much in the recruiting process, like the hospitals do. You get your five visits, and so you know I said before I make a decision, I'm gonna take all five visits. You know, see what's out there, see what would be the best fit for me. And so I took on one visit, and then Missouri was the next visit. And just pretty much, it was me and my mom and my quarterback coach, Ramon Robinson. And I remember being at the airport right before we got picked up. And I was like, man, this is just a visit. I just want to say I came to Missouri. I'm definitely, it's too far from home for me. I don't even want to go, but you know, time I got there, got greeted by Austin Carter Samuels, one of the quarterback guys there, and just seeing the love and just the support, and then just getting to know Coach Derek Dooley. You know, he's just coming from the Cowboys, and seeing the work that he'd done with Drew Locke the year before, and how he got him, you know, in the position, you know, to be a high draft pick, and just the transformation that he made in the year and within the offense. And I was like, you know, that could be the spot for me. I can definitely see myself coming to a situation, you know, thriving in, and then all the guys, you know, was pouring into me, you know, why you should be here, you know, what they loved about the organization, the whole program. So, you know, I just feel like all, you know, the stars were aligned for me to be a Mizzou Tiger.
Kelly Bryant joining us. You know, Kelly, it's a great story. It makes sense. However, there's more to it. In fact, there's so many stories from your time at Missouri about how you impacted the people around you. There was the academic fraud investigation last January. It resulted in a ruling where all of Missouri's seniors could transfer and not have to sit out. You had only recently arrived at Missouri, but you get up in a meeting and you say that you're staying. Linebacker Cale Garrett said, quote, "I'd only known the guy for a week," and he's saying that it was definitely a respect moment. That's when he truly won me over, end quote. So what moved you to speak, and what did you say in that moment?
The biggest thing was, you know, it was just a weird day, to be honest. Like, we had got a team meeting out of nowhere, and, like, all the players and all of us, we wasn't sure, you know, what was going on. And then coaches just, you know, was kind of giving off, you know, not so good vibes. So in the back of my head, I'm like, somebody get fired? You know, it's like, what's going on? And so when Coach Odom, you know, delivered the news, you know, he left nothing, you know, behind closed doors. He laid it out there, you know, as much information that he knew to all of us. And, you know, he said, you know, seniors, anybody, you know, you have the opportunity. You can leave if you want to. No one's going to look at you any differently. And for me, like I said, I just got there. And I was like, man, I do not want to go through the recruiting phase again. And I learned a whole new coaching staff and the program already, you know, invested, you know, like I said, a couple of weeks I already been there, you know, I'm getting to know guys and I'm building a relationship. You know, the last thing I want to do is walk out the door as soon as things just went bad. And, you know, something like you said just got into me where I had to, you know, just get up and say, you know, I'm staying. You know, I just want to be a part of this program, you know, just try to, you know, flip the script on this whole, you know, story that we already got, you know, going in through the new year already.
Kelly Bryant joining me for another moment or so. You know, Kelly, something else the guys around you talk about is, you know, aside from your ability to lead from the front and impact others, you have this great ability to block out the noise around you. Now, you know how this works, right? The draft evaluation process, everybody is going to pick you and everybody else apart to try to find something wrong with you. So how are you approaching it? How do you block out that noise and just be sure to get in and do your work every single day and not get impacted by anything negative?
Through this process, just never get tired of telling your story. You know, like I said, guys been telling me you're going to be saying the same thing over and over. It's going to be mentally draining. But you never know, you know, who's that story may connect to and who might fall in love with you. And, you know, like I said, that's just an opportunity for me to tell my story and let people know the real Kelly B, you know, what they're going to get, you know, if they decide to call on my name. So, you know, just being mentally strong and not listening on what's going on, just listening to any doubt or whatever may be going on around you, and just continue to stay positive and, you know, just not getting tired of doing the routine things.
Kelly, last thought. I mean, you've demonstrated this in the entire conversation you and I have had, but obviously teams are going to want to see what you can do physically, and you'll show that. But what do you want teams to know about you as a leader and as a person?
What you see is what you get. I'm gonna be a committed guy. I'm a winner. You know, I'm a perfectionist. You know, I just want to do everything, you know, in the best of my interest, you know, to give everything to an organization. You know, I'm not going to be perfect, but I'm going to strive to be perfect. And, you know, you're not going to have to worry about anything outside of the field. You know, I'm going to be a high-character guy who holds myself to a standard, a high standard as well.
He played quarterback at Missouri. He was a national champion. The numbers speak for themselves. You've got the NFL Combine getting underway Sunday in Indianapolis. You have the draft itself, April 23rd through the 25th in Las Vegas. It has been called the biggest job interview ever. It's a good way of looking at it. Kelly Bryant, my guest. Kelly, so good to get caught up with you. I really appreciate your thoughts. I'll look forward to seeing where you end up, where you get to live and work. And it's great to have you back on the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on.
Instead of talking about cheating in baseball, why don't we talk about cheating in another sport? A sport where it is really frowned upon, even more so than baseball. In fact, on some level in baseball, cheating was accepted. Like, it was okay to cheat in baseball as long as you cheated the right way. You just can't cheat with technology. Or as Clayton Kershaw put it, you can't cheat in real time. In golf, as an example, you can't cheat at all. That's the gentleman's game, the gentleman's sport. So now it's been a few months since Patrick Reed went Patrick Cheat, allegedly. I'm going to say that because my man is very litigious. Patrick Cheat, allegedly, was in a waste bunker back in December at the Hero World Challenge and is bad. As much as he would like that story to go away, it's just not. And two of the more damning takes on this guy landed this week. So check this out. Pat, it's going to get worse before it gets better. Much worse. Why don't we start with Brooks Koepka? Now, it has been a minute or two since anybody heard from the former number one stick in the world because BK had been rehabbing a knee that slid out of place twice since last August. Now, he actually put a peg in the ground at a couple of events overseas, and he made his stateside debut this past week at RIV. But since the cat was spraying Bridgestones from Santa Monica to Calabasas, all eyes and headlines were on that guy, like they often are. As for Brooks, you know, he never threatened to take down the Genesis either, but nobody expected him to. This guy's been in full bullpen session mode until Augusta, where he finished a shot back of Elgato last year. I mean, we know Brooks will show up for the big events and take them down and dominate. This is what he does. Just as he will show up, and if you ask him a question, he will answer it. One of the only guys that will do so. And golf is so much better for it. Calling out dudes for slow play, body bagging Bryson DeChambeau with a picture of his U.S. Open and PGA Championship trophies, and then coming on this show to say that he was shocked that he did not win the Player of the Year award last season despite ripping two majors to Rory's none.
I was kind of shocked at it, that I didn't win Player of the Year. Let's be honest, the trophy's named after Jack Nicklaus. I mean, obviously, majors do matter. I find that kind of ironic. All you're remembered by is how many majors you win. that's what you're based on. It's one of those things where, yeah, I'm surprised. I felt like I had a good enough year to win player of the year, but at the same time, obviously I need to play better.
What a great conversation. He's so right in what he says, too. But then again, Brooks usually is right. And you got to look far and wide on tour to find a guy who's going to speak their mind half as much as Brooks Koepka. And to do it while on top of the golf universe makes it so much better. Think about this. I mean, like, every guy's different. Tiger Woods went his entire career without saying one thing. That's not easy to do. Like, he never said anything. Koepka, also on top of the golf world, will answer any question you ask him. As long as he's there and he's talking, he will. You know, we're not talking about some scrub running junk and inviting crossfire. We're talking about the second-ranked player in the world in his prime doing it. And since Brooks was on the shelf when Pat Reed was in the waste bunker doing some landscaping with a wedge turned backhoe, nobody was able to get BK's thoughts on the incident. But now, Brooks is back on tour, and he's back letting it rip once again because he appeared on Sirius XM. And they asked him straight up to go back to that Patrick Reed controversy and answer the question, Brooks, was Reed cheating?
Was he cheating?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what he was doing building sandcastles in the sand, but you know where your club is. I mean, I took 3 months off, and I can promise you I know if I touch sand. If you look at the video, obviously he grazes his hand twice, and then he still chops down on it. If you play the game, you understand the rules. You understand, you know, the integrity that goes on, and there's no room for it.
Man, this guy is so awesome. That's why 3 months without Brooks Koepka felt like three decades. My man just went full Happy Gilmore heckler on Pat Reed.
You're going to need a blanket and suntan lotion because you're never going to get off that beach, you jackass.
Like, a lot of guys had a problem with Pat Reed's act in the bunker, but it was pretty clear that they were told to keep their mouth shut about that. You know, that sort of thing's obviously not going to work with BK. No one's going to tell this guy what he can and can't say. Otherwise, he would have just said, yeah, maybe, kinda. What he said was, yes, he cheated. Yes, he was building sandcastles. Yes, he cheated. I took 3 months off, and I still always knew where my club is. And I promise you, I know if I touch sand. And anybody who plays knows, and that there is no room for it. So he didn't pull any punches at all, like he never does. The only other person in golf who's been that critical of Pat Reed is Brandel Chambly from the Golf Channel, which is kind of funny because BC and BK do not see eye to eye at all. That's been pretty well documented. But BC and BK could be in the same courtroom facing down the same legal team because back in January, Reed lawyered up and sent a letter to the Chambly or to him telling him, quote, refrain from any further dissemination, publication, or republication of false and defamatory statements concerning Mr. Reed, including allegations that he cheated at the Hero World Challenge, end quote. He lawyered up. In other words, keep calling me a cheater and I will sue you.
Cheater!
Now, Brandel never had to worry about getting paired with Reed out on the track. Brooks does. Although I don't think that Brooks really cares about that. He's taken aim at slow playing. He's called these guys out by name. And he still does his job really, really well. So here's to Pat Reed trying to serve Brooks papers to appear in court next time they see each other. And here's to BK not giving a damn at all. Welcome back, Brooks. The game missed you. The sport is much better when you're stacking majors and taking down cheaters and slow players. In fact, the whole world is. Pat Reed. Oh, there's more, too, where that came from. That's one take. Take two is Pat Reed getting taken down by a 27-year PGA Tour broadcaster in Peter Costas. Now, Costas is not currently working the tour anymore, so he's not beholden to anybody. Nobody's going to tell him what he can and can't say. So he let it rip himself on the most recent episode of No Laying Up podcast, which dropped yesterday. The host of that program brought up Pat Reed, and then Costas brought out his shovel. Listen to what he had to say about it.
I've seen Patrick Reed improve his lie up close and personal 4 times now.
That's the only time I ever shut McCord up. He didn't know what to say. When I said, well, you know, the lie that I saw originally wouldn't have allowed for this shot. Because he put four or five clubs behind the ball, kind of faking whether he's going to hit this shot or hit that shot, whatever. By the time he was done, he hit a freaking three wood out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Which when I saw it was a sand wedge layup originally. I was in the tower at 16 at San Diego on the par three during Golf Channel telecast, and he hit it over the green and did the same thing, put three or four clubs behind, and it was really a treacherous shot that nobody had gotten it close all day long from over there. And by the time he was done, I could read Callaway on the golf ball from my tower. But I can't say anything. I can't be the story. Now I'm done. I don't really care.
Is that something you see run rampant on the PGA Tour? Like from a
No.
So it wasn't a surprise to you when all the stuff happened in the Bahamas?
No.
I mean, damn. Peter Costas just said that he's seen Patrick Reed improve his lie four times. And that Reed takes out clubs in the rough, faking like he's figuring out a shot, only to take out and ultimately hit three wood. Implication being, if you don't play, is that Reed's using the clubs to tamp down the grass behind his ball and going through his act that buys him time to do it and acting like he's practicing, and after he has the lie that he wants, then he rips the bigger stick. So you've got Brooks calling him a cheater, and then you've got Costas saying he's seen it four different times, and that back in the day when he was working the events, he couldn't say anything, but now that he's not, he can say whatever the hell he wants, and he's here to say that. And that no, other guys on tour are not doing it. And that what happened in the Bahamas is not surprising at all. Now listen, the thing about Pat Reed is you have to understand, if you're going to come at him like that and accuse him of that, understand that he's going to want to sue you and anybody else who says that. He's going to want to sue everybody off the face of the earth who's calling him a cheat. I don't know. I'm going to be very careful. I'm not saying you are, Pat. I'm saying these two guys are saying that you are, Pat. Like, I mean, I want to say, hey, Pat, I mean, you're a cheater, bro.
Allegedly.
And not a one-off or a two-off necessarily. According to Costas, a four-off. This is like serial. Allegedly. That is amazing. In a sport where not only is it frowned upon, not only is it a reason to go, it's like the worst thing ever in that sport. You just don't do it. Not in the gentleman's sport.
I don't know what he was doing building sandcastles in the sand.
Roman Josi is my guest. Roman, it's good to have you on the show. How are you?
Thanks. I appreciate it. I'm good. How are you?
Good. Great. Great to have you on. Thank you so much. You did drop a tough one to Carolina on Tuesday night, which snapped a three-game winning streak. You said after the game that it just was not a great performance by the team overall. When you get to a point in the season, this point, how important is it to be able to move on quickly from a loss like that and get ready for that next game?
It's really important. I mean, every game matters a lot right now, I think, for every team. And we're playing another Central Division in Chicago tomorrow. So I think no matter if you lose or win, you gotta move on the next day and focus on that next game.
Now, the last month, the team made the decision to move on from Peter Laviolette as head coach. What was your reaction when you heard that news?
To be honest, I was shocked at first. I mean, it happened pretty quick. And Lavi's been our coach for around 6 years now, and obviously he built a relationship with the coach, and he did a lot of good things for the organization, so it came a little bit as a shock, and it happened pretty quick.
Yeah, it happened pretty quick, and it's got to be kind of a jarring thing, Roman. So as the captain, how do you go about handling that change with your teammates and making sure that everybody is locked in and dialed in? What was your approach?
Well, I think you obviously as a team, you talk a lot with the leadership group, and I remember it happened on a Monday, and we played the next day, so it was a quick turnaround. The new coach came in, Heinze, and talked to us for a little bit, and then it's just pretty quick, goes back to business as usual.
Roman Josi joining us. All right, so what about John Heinze? He's your new head coach. What kind of an adjustment process has it been like working with him, and what's he been like to play for?
He's been great. I mean, there's I think some changes in the system that we had to get used to after playing for Lavi for so many years. But he's a great coach. He's awesome, great guy. So I think you could see the past month we've been getting better in this system, and we're still trying to improve.
Now, Roman, getting that C on your jersey is such a unique thing in that game and in your sport. I know you take that role as captain extremely seriously. When you were coming up as a player, who were some of the captains that you learned from, and what did you learn from them?
In Nashville, I had Shea Weber and Mike Fisher as a captain who were unbelievable captains. I mean, I think the biggest thing I learned from them was just the way they led by example. I think every time you watch them come to the rink, they put in the work in practice, they put in the work in the games, and they're always the hardest working guys. And I think as a young kid, it's pretty special to see that.
Roman Josi is joining us. Now, the team itself went through kind of a tough stretch earlier in the season, but you've won 7 of your last 10. What has been the biggest difference on the ice of late?
I think just getting adjusted to the new system, and the consistency has been a lot better. The first, 40 or 50 games, we played really inconsistent and had some good stretches in games, but then also had a lot of stretches where we didn't play well. And I think the past couple of games we've been playing more consistency and playing well for 60 minutes.
Now, you were named to your third All-Star game this year. I'm curious, what did the honor mean to you this time? And what's the All-Star game experience like for you? Like, are there other guys that you're kind of seeking out to talk to and hang out with? How do you approach that aspect?
Yeah, it's awesome. I love it. It's a lot of fun. And it's every time you get to go, it's a huge honor. And every All-Star game was pretty special. I mean, at my first one in Nashville, which was obviously pretty cool. But there's so many good players there and guys you know a little bit from the All-Star games, and it's always fun to catch up with them.
Roman, your offensive numbers this year are amazing, and you're getting a lot of attention as a potential Norris Trophy candidate. How would you describe your approach when it comes to the right balance between offense and defense and jumping into the play or not?
You're right. You gotta find that balance. I mean, you're as a defenseman, your main goal is to play well defensively, but I think my game, I want to jump up in the play. I want to create something offensively, and I think you have to find the right time, and you can't play offense either. So I think it's just a kind of a read on the ice when to jump up and when not.
I got to ask you, the fact that we're talking about multiple All-Star games, a potential Norris Trophy, this doesn't really come as a surprise to anybody who knows the career you've had. But you've said that growing up in Switzerland, the NHL seems so far away. What do you remember about the NHL when you were a kid, and what kind of thoughts did you have then?
I remember Don Cherry's videos. That's pretty much all we got when we were younger, and we didn't watch a lot of games. Obviously, we saw a lot of highlights, but it was always pretty far. I mean, I grew up in Bern, and I used to watch my hometown team, and then all of a sudden there's some Swiss guys playing in the NHL, and I think you watch those guys, and it came a little closer, and you saw as a Swiss kid that there's a way to make it to the NHL.
And then what about Mark Streit? Mark Streit makes it to the NHL. What did it mean to you to see that? I mean, did that make you feel like that was something you could do when you saw that?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I'll tell everyone I think he opened a lot of doors for us young kids. I mean, he was we had a couple goalies, but he was the first player who really made it, and he kind of fought his way up through the AHL and East Coast League, and I think that opened a lot of doors for us young kids, and our mindset kind of changed. Like I said, he was always so far away, but you saw him make it, and I think he gave a lot of young kids a lot of confidence.
Roman, one last thought. Whenever I talk to anybody involved with the Preds, they always talk about the city of Nashville. When the news broke that Nashville was going to be an NHL city, there was some skepticism, but the fan base there is absolutely amazing. What's it like to play in front of those fans in Smashville?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, if you ever have a chance to come down for a game on a Saturday in Smashville, it's pretty special. I think it's one of the loudest rinks in the league, and the fans are pretty wild, and like that cup run we had was unbelievable. The whole city was behind us, and it's a pretty special place, so it's a lot of fun.
What's it like for you to live in the Nashville area?
It's awesome. I mean, I got drafted 2008 and didn't know much about Nashville, but I think the first thing I always tell people, it's unbelievable how nice people are in Nashville. They're really friendly, and yeah, this place really became home for me the last couple of years.
Nashville is at Chicago tomorrow night. They're 3 points out of a wild card spot. He is a three-time All-Star. He is a President's Trophy winner and getting a lot of attention for the Norris Trophy as well. Roman Josi, my guest. Roman, thank you so much, and really nice to have you on the show.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Good night now!